Here are the headlines from San Francisco. Dean Gildersleeve cites Economic and Social Council as the most constructive part of San Francisco Conference's work. Archibald MacLeish sees United Nations Charter as realistic approach to world organization. This is the eighth of a group of State Department programs entitled Report from San Francisco, presented by NBC's University of the Air as part of a larger series giving authoritative interpretations of our foreign policy. Assistant Secretary of State Archibald MacLeish is with us again, and with him is Dean Virginia Gildersleeve of Barnard College, New York, a member of the United States delegation to the United Nations Conference. They will be introduced by Selden Menefee of NBC's University of the Air. Mr. Menefee.
Our original plan for this broadcast was to deal solely with the General Assembly and the Economic and Social Council. But because of the imminent closing of the conference, perhaps as soon as next week, this is to be the final broadcast of the series Report from San Francisco, and it is an appropriate time for a general summing up. Assistant Secretary of State MacLeish and Dean Gildersleeve have therefore undertaken to start off with an overall account of the charter which is being drawn up here. Mr. MacLeish, how would you sum it up?
Well, I wish I could sum it up, or rather I wish somebody who knew a good deal more about it than I do would sum it up. Down to this time, the charter has been a good deal like the elephant in the fable of the blind man and the elephant. One man gets hold of the trunk and calls it a snake. Another man gets hold of the left hind leg and calls it a tree. It finally took a man with eyes, you remember, to see that the snake and the tree and the tusks and the tail all added up to an elephant. It'll take a man with eyes to see that the United Nations Charter, which has been described in terms of everything from the General Assembly to the 16 poles, who incidentally never had anything to do with the charter or with San Francisco, it'll take a man with eyes to see that the charter is actually a whole and complete animal with characteristics and qualities of its own.
You sound as if you thought it was a whole and entire organism, then.
Well, I do. I don't think I've seen it whole enough to be able to describe it in terms which would satisfy a naturalist of political institutions, but I have a rough idea of its appearance. To begin with, if I may push this metaphor into the ground where it belongs, the charter has two heads. That is to say, it is a declaration and it is a constitution. As a declaration, it states the high purposes of peace and human welfare which the United Nations agree to promote and maintain. As a constitution, it creates certain social instruments, certain international social instruments, to enable those high principles and purposes to realize themselves in action in the political world. You can put the same thing in other terms by saying that the charter is at once idealistic and realistic. It declares the ideal purposes of the organization to maintain international peace and security, and it provides the means by which those ideal purposes are to be realized in the world as it actually is.
Some people think the charter is a little too realistic, Mr. MacLeish. Some, in fact, would even use the word cynical instead of realistic.
I know, we've all heard that kind of talk, but take the actual facts. The principal purpose of the charter is to maintain international peace and security. Now, the charter proposes to do that not by fiat, not by mere declaration, as in the case of the Kellogg-Briand Pact, but by creating a security council with power and with the right to use it if necessary. Now, the facts about power in the contemporary world are facts which people may not like, but they are facts notwithstanding. One of them is the fact that power is unequally distributed. A small number of nations have far more power than all the rest put together. If you want to use power, you've got to use the power that exists, and the Charter does precisely that. It entrusts the nations which possess power with the duty and responsibility of using their power for the maintenance of the peace. And, taking account of the facts of the actual world again, the Charter further provides that the nations which possess power shall use it in concert and in agreement with each other, and that they shan't use it when they are disagreed. And the reason for that is simple enough. If the great powers are in disagreement, and if force is used by some of them against the will of the others, the result may not be to maintain the peace, but to start a major war.
I think most people would agree, Mr. MacLeish, that the Security Council takes account of the facts of life. But what about the other instruments created by the Charter to enable it to realize, as you put it, its purposes and ideals? How about the Economic and Social Council, which Dean Gildersleeve has worked so hard to create? How realistic is that?
Well, I think Dean Gildersleeve ought to answer that question. My opinion, for whatever it's worth, would be that the Economic and Social Council, though considerably less realistic than the Security Council, is nevertheless realistic enough to work. It has the power to initiate studies, the power to make reports, the power to ask for reports from the member states and from other organizations, the power to call international conferences, and the power to prepare draft conventions. Now, if you add all those powers up together in a world in which public opinion is an increasingly powerful factor, and in a field in which public opinion is directly and intensely interested, you get a social instrument which ought to be able to produce results and produce them fast.
Of course, Mr. McLeish, you've left out in your discussion of the Charter what seems to me to be an essential observation. The United Nations, the new organization which is to be called the United Nations, will succeed only insofar as we make it succeed by good hard work. We can build the machinery here, but it won't run unless the people of the world supply the motive power to make it run. I think for myself that the motive power will express itself principally through the General Assembly of the United Nations and the Economic and Social Council.
You spoke a moment ago of the importance of world opinion in all this, Mr. McLeish. I'm not sure that I agree with you that world opinion is becoming an increasingly powerful factor. There is a rather disturbing tendency toward the establishment of national monopolies in the informational field in certain countries.
That's true. And one of the principal jobs of the United Nations, in my opinion, will be the job of reversing that trend before it is too late, and establishing not only the principles, but the practices of freedom of exchange of information. Freedom of exchange not as between nations, but as between peoples. The United States delegation, you remember, is already on record as believing that the fundamental freedoms recognized by the Charter include freedom of speech, and that freedom of speech includes freedom of exchange of information. The next job to be done is to give those noble principles the tools to work with. It ought to be done fast. But I'd like to get Dean Gildersleeve's reaction to the question you were asking me, Mr. Menefee, about the Charter as a whole. Does it come up to your expectations?
Well, it seemed to me that the Dumbarton Oaks proposals were pretty good, and we've improved on them. There'll still be room for more improvement, of course. It can come only through experience and adjustment. But I think that over the years, we should be able to translate our further objectives into action by revising the Charter.
It might be useful here to list some of the ways in which the present Charter does represent an improvement over Dumbarton Oaks. I'll put in one. There's been a clear statement of purposes. The Charter's basic aims are peace, security, justice, human rights, international law.
And that has been implemented, too, by the definite provision for a Human Rights Commission. In fact, that commission, which was considered such a controversial matter in the beginning, was made mandatory under the Charter.
Those are two very definite advances. And you can add that the functions of the Security Council and the General Assembly have been made definite and specific.
Then, too, a plan for trusteeship has been agreed on, a plan which is far superior to the old lead mandate system in its basic human objectives and in the degree of control exercised by the United Nations to prevent abuses.
The trusteeship arrangements have come in for some criticism, of course.
Well, there's room for honest criticism of every part of the Charter. But I think a good deal of the criticism you're talking about is properly directed to an earlier stage of the text. As it's now written, the first part of the trusteeship chapter applies to the whole colonial problem. It binds the member states to accept, and I'm quoting, the general principle that it is a sacred trust of civilization to promote to the utmost the well-being of the inhabitants of dependent territories.
All of which sounds beautiful, Mr. McLeish, but what does it mean?
Well, you know what it means. It means, in the language of the Charter, to ensure their economic and social advancement, to develop self-government in forms appropriate to the particular circumstances, and to further international peace and security. No such commitment has ever before been advanced internationally, and certainly no such commitment has ever before been accepted. Those of us who would like to see the whole arrangement go considerably further can take comfort in the text as it now stands.
It may be better to wait until less turbulent times to consider some of these problems, rather than trying to solve them all at once. There's one observation I'd like to add, Mr. McLeish, if you don't mind my changing the subject a bit. It's an aspect of the whole problem that interests me very much. It's very difficult to translate democracy into a world organization. We think of the General Assembly as democratic because it has one vote per member nation. Yet it can be argued that it's undemocratic to give one vote each to Ecuador and the Soviet Union, and one each to Luxembourg and the United States.
Well, that's an interesting observation. Would you go so far as to say that the system of representation we have on the Security Council, with the five large nations in permanent seats and the six smaller ones in temporary seats, is more democratic than the Assembly?
Well, at least it balances the picture.
In any event, the keystone of the new structure is the cooperation of the five great powers. Unless they stand together, there's no hope of building permanent peace.
And the United Nations organization will bind them closer together, and with them, all the other peaceful countries of the world.
There's been a good deal of discussion on the question of whether the conference itself has been democratically organized, democratically run. The argument usually takes the form of the small nations versus the big five. Very few people realize that the so-called Little 45 had a big hand in writing the charter. I believe that some 636 amendments were offered by the smaller nations. A good many of these overlapped, of course, but there must have been 400 of them, more or less, which have been incorporated into the charter, at least so far as their essential meaning was concerned. I should say that was a pretty impressive record.
Many of the 29 amendments that were sponsored by the five major nations incorporated suggestions made by the smaller countries.
I believe almost every amendment adopted operated to liberalize the charter also, which means that the small nations can take a good deal of credit for the fact that the charter is more liberal now than it was. For example, the adoption of full employment as a goal of the Economic and Social Council was an Australian proposal, wasn't it?
And New Zealand helped to make that council one of the principal bodies of the organization. And in the preamble, the safeguarding of human rights and fundamental freedoms as an objective was advocated by Mexico, Brazil, the Dominican Republic, and Ecuador. Education as a major objective of the trusteeship system was proposed by Iran.
Canada was responsible, I understand, for the amendment giving any nation furnishing troops to the Security Council for enforcement a chance to vote on the use of those troops.
While you're talking about amendments, if I may interrupt, I think it would be of interest to describe what has happened to the General Assembly. One of the most impressive developments here has been the expansion of the Assembly's powers, wouldn't you say, Mr. McLeish? A writer in the San Francisco Chronicle remarked the other day that the General Assembly, which had come to the San Francisco Conference as a mouse, emerged a man.
You might have said to some others. That's another example of the way the middle and smaller nations have influenced the work of the conference. But we're getting into Dean Gildersleeve's special field.
The Assembly's scope has been broadened greatly from the Dumbarton Oaks proposals. All but one or two of the amendments voted by the committee for this purpose were accepted by the five major powers.
You remember, the Assembly was called a glorified debating society more than once before the San Francisco Conference took it in hand.
Well, the primary function of the General Assembly still is to serve as a forum of world opinion. But it has taken on new responsibilities, too. The Assembly can consider any matter that affects international relations. It can make recommendations to the Security Council on any matter, unless it's already being considered by the Council. The Security Council must report to the Assembly on steps it takes to enforce peace. And the Assembly can consider the question of armaments and make recommendations for their control.
And then, of course, the Assembly will elect the six non-permanent members of the Security Council. With the participation of the Security Council, it will elect the Secretary General and the Justices of the International Court, and it will admit new members of the United Nations or suspend the privileges of old members. On top of all that, it's empowered to pass upon the budgets of the various branches of the organization.
All of which certainly makes the Assembly a powerful body in its own right. It'll meet regularly only once a year, but special sessions may be called at any time. The Assembly also has the power to set up various subsidiary commissions, and these, together with the permanent secretariat or staff, would carry on its work when the Assembly is not in session.
First and foremost of the groups which will be under the supervision of the Assembly, of course, is the Economic and Social Council. One of the local papers called it the soul of the charter the other day.
Well, Mr. McLeish, I don't think I'd put it quite like that, the soul of the charter. But I do think it's the most constructive part of our work here. The Security Council, after all, is designed to prevent wars, whereas the Economic and Social Council is designed to build the conditions for peace, to remove the economic and social causes of war.
Dean Gildersleeve, I attended the commission meeting which approved the report of your committee early this week, approved it unanimously, in fact. What was behind that unanimity? Weren't there a good many hot issues that had to be straightened out behind the scenes?
Yes, Mr. Menefee, there were some questions that weren't easy to solve. For example, the wording of the full employment objective. which some feared might imply interference in the domestic affairs of a country. But that was really a matter of wording. It was settled by including in the committee's records a statement that nothing in the chapter should be construed as authorizing any such interference. There was no real disagreement on the objectives of the council or on how it would function. Such questions as arose, we were able to settle in committee, so we could bring in a unanimous report. And this was due largely to our remarkably wise and efficient chairman, Sir A. Ramaswamy Mudaliar, chairman of the delegation from India.
That's very interesting, but what do you think the Economic and Social Council will amount to in actual practice, Dean Gildersleeve?
It'll be what we make it, like every other branch of the United Nations. Of course, it will operate on a voluntary basis, but that's the way it should be. All the delegates were agreed on that. It'll stimulate discussion and make studies and recommendations. That's all it's intended to do, but a lot can be accomplished that way.
It's right here in the chapter on the Economic and Social Council that the advance of San Francisco over Dumbarton Oaks becomes most apparent. Its objectives were pretty vague before. Now they're explicit. Higher living standards, which is an explicit thing, full employment, better health conditions, cultural and educational cooperation among nations, and universal respect for human rights.
The Council has acquired many new functions, too. It can call international conferences on economic and social problems, as Mr. McLeish pointed out. It can draft conventions for submission to the Assembly. It can make recommendations on its own initiative to protect the basic human rights and freedoms. And it will perform services and make special studies at the request of member nations or of other branches of the United Nations organization, such as the Trusteeship Council, for example. That might become a very significant tie-up.
How would you describe the functional relation of the Economic and Social Council, its relation to the larger organization, Dean Gildersleeve?
It will be under the authority of the Assembly, of course. But it will have the tremendous job of supervising the work of the commissions it will establish, Commission on Human Rights and others in the economic and social fields. And then, too, it will coordinate the semi-autonomous United Nations Organization on Food and Agriculture, the International Bank and Monetary Fund proposed at Bretton Woods, and so on.
And how about UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration?
That's in a different category, Mr. Menifee. It's a temporary organization, so it'll remain separate. But several additional organizations may be set up in this field. There's already talk of international conferences on health, on education, and on trade. I wouldn't be surprised to see new organizations formed in these fields. They'd be semi-autonomous, but the Economic and Social Council would try to keep them from overlapping or working at cross-purposes.
And will this Economic and Social Council be more or less continuous in its sessions, like the Security Council?
Well, the Charter doesn't say, but I think it'll have to meet more or less continuously to do its job. It won't be a large organization, you know. It will have only 18 members.
I understand there was some lively discussion of that in your committee, Dean Gildersleeve, that there's some suggestion that there should be representatives from all 50 nations, or at least from countries from every region of the world. And there was a proposal that the Big Five should be represented on the Council.
Well, they probably will be, though that's left for the Assembly to decide. So's the question of regional representation. But I'm quite certain the Assembly will see to it that every part of the world is represented.
And the Council will be able to deal directly with any or all of the United Nations, whether or not they are directly represented on the Council itself. But so far, we've been pretty vague in general about the actual work of the Economic and Social Council. Can we put it more precisely, Dean Gildersleeve?
That's a little hard to do at this point, Mr. McLeish, because we've purposely avoided putting down exact duties and organizational details in the Charter. We prefer to let the Council itself work out the details within the general field turned over to it by the conference.
You know, I think it would help us to get a picture of this indirectly. If you would be willing to describe some of the economic and social problems you discussed in your technical committee.
Well, Mr. McLeish, at one of our most interesting meetings, a number of statements were made that gave some indication of the thinking of the committee members. We didn't pass resolutions, and we didn't try to bind the Economic and Social Council to a definite policy in advance, but we did make a number of statements for the record.
A description of that discussion might give us some idea of the sort of thing you think the Council is going to deal with.
At that particular meeting, the delegates from Brazil and China presented a declaration on health. They urged that a conference be convened in the next few months to set up an international health organization, as I mentioned a few minutes ago. A number of other delegates spoke in favor of this, and I believe it will be held. The British delegate, Miss Florence Horsburgh, a member of Parliament attached to the Ministry of Health, gave a very interesting speech on this subject, and especially on the health of British children. I think we all realize that with hundreds of thousands of homes broken up or destroyed by the Blitz in England, a lot of rebuilding will have to be done. And it's up to the countries that have suffered least, like the United States, to help in the rebuilding.
Of course, the feeding and housing of the children of England and Holland and Poland and Greece can't wait for this new organization of ours. That has to be done now. I imagine that's what UNRWA and the other relief organizations are for.
I know, but after their funds are gone and they fold up, we'll still need an international organization of some kind to continue their work. At least a fact-finding and advisory organization. And that's where the Economic and Social Council would come in. Meanwhile, some sort of interim organization should be set up. And later a commission on child welfare might be set up under the council to supplement the work of a semi-autonomous health organization. I do know this. We women of the United States of America should salute the women of the devastated countries. They've certainly fought well and suffered bravely. And we trust we may have the privilege of assisting them now in the restoring of their homes and the strengthening of their children to carry the ideals of the United Nations into the future.
And what about cultural and educational cooperation? We'll have some sort of an organization there, too, I understand. What would it do, Dean Gildersleeve?
The United Nations Organization on Educational and Cultural Cooperation will be set up to gather and give out information on various educational subjects to help rebuild libraries in devastated areas, for example, and to arrange exchanges of teachers, students, books, newspapers, motion pictures, and radio programs among the various countries, on a voluntary basis, of course. Anything which would build up understanding among nations.
You don't expect this work to be carried on by a commission under the Economic and Social Council, then?
No, the feeling in our committee was that these questions ought not to be dealt with directly by the council or through its commission, but by a semi-autonomous international organization. The French talked a great deal about intellectual cooperation and made a statement about the need for an international conference on this subject. And I think a call for this will go out soon. Our own government, the British government, and the Conference of Allied Ministers of Education in London have been working toward this end for some time. It's my understanding that a draft charter for a United Nations organization in this field has already been worked out in a preliminary Dumbarton Oaks sort of way. Is that right, Mr. McLeish?
It has. That's quite right.
And then there'll be other commissions, of course. The Human Rights Commission is expected to draft a Bill of Rights for all mankind that will be comparable to the Bill of Rights in our own Constitution. It will investigate abuses in this field, do continuous research, and in general serve as the conscience of the United Nations.
And what about future studies by the Council, Dean Gildersleeve?
A number of suggestions have been made. The delegate from Panama suggested that studies of migration should be made, looking toward uniform standards for dealing with immigrants and emigrants. Other delegates were interested in the position of women, especially Dr. Bertha Lutz, Brazil's able woman delegate. The women of many countries, of course, don't even have the right to vote, much less equality of economic opportunity. I believe the Council can deal with this sort of thing. Where women as a group suffer from discrimination, I believe the Commission on Human Rights contemplated in the Charter will be effective. Moreover, I hope that the excellent work of that committee of jurists appointed by the League of Nations to study the legal status of women throughout the world may be continued in an appropriate form, either as an advisory body to the Economic and Social Council or as a part of the Commission on Human Rights.
Speaking of the League, Dean Gildersleeve, what's to be done in two of the fields in which the League was most successful, control of opium and white slavery? Those undertakings would seem to fall within the sphere of this council you're describing.
I told the technical committee not long ago, Mr. McLeish, that we ought to do everything possible to safeguard the continued operation of the agencies that have worked so effectively to control the drug traffic. In fact, the United States delegation is on record as hoping that the United Nations will be entrusted with supervision over the execution of traffic in opium and other dangerous drugs. Our delegation also says that an advisory body should be established to help the Economic and Social Council in handling this problem. And I think a similar line may be followed with regard to the white slave traffic. And then, of course, the Economic and Social Council we'll be working on trade agreements and other commercial matters.
I think you've made your point about the importance of the Economic and Social Council, Dean Gildersleeve. The Council may turn out to be an even more significant part of the United Nations organization than the Security Council.
I'd go so far as to say that if the Economic and Social Council does its job well, with the wholehearted cooperation of the various nations, eventually, there may be very little need for the Security Council's function of settling disputes. If the League of Nations had had such a permanent, unified council, supported by all the major countries, I believe it would have gone a long way toward removing some of the basic causes of this war. As Field Marshal Smuts of South Africa has said, one of the most potent causes of war is social and economic unrest. I believe the Economic and Social Council offers the best hope our time has had for the establishment of a positive and creative peace, such as Field Marshal Smuts has in mind.
Well, I don't want to interrupt this, but I want to say that you've summarized the work of the conference very well, Dean Gildersleeve and Mr. McLeish. But now, before we go off the air, I'd like to add just a word for NBC.
All right, Mr. Menifee.
This was the last program of the State Department and U.S. delegation series, Report from San Francisco. On behalf of NBC's University of the Air, I want to thank the people who have made it possible to give you this week-by-week official account of the highlights of the United Nations Conference, and especially Assistant Secretary of State McLeish, who has given so generously of his time and efforts to help bring the facts to the American people. And our thanks also to Dean Gildersleeve and the other members of the U.S. delegation, most of whom have appeared twice on these programs, and to the advisors, consultants, and officials of the State Department and the International Secretariat who have also contributed. They've been busy, all of them, with a heavy schedule of meetings and conferences and reports. Yet they realize the importance of these programs enough to find time somehow to pass their special knowledge on to the people of America, and by shortwave radio to the people of other countries and through the facilities of the Armed Forces Radio Service to our servicemen and women throughout the world. Now, a number of people have written in to ask just how these programs are produced. Mr. McLeish, you answered that question in some detail a few months ago on one of these programs. But I think this much will bear repeating. We do use written scripts, but the scripts are taken from actual conversations, from transcripts of real discussion as it took place in the offices of the participants a few days earlier. This method saves the time of the participants and at the same time enables us to bring you the frankest, most informal treatment possible of the problems of our foreign policy. Next week's Our Foreign Policy program will originate in Washington. It will be the first of several broadcasts featuring members of Congress on questions of international relations. Following these programs, we expect to return to the State Department and other government agencies dealing with foreign policy as changing conditions warrant. Until then, thank you again, Mr. McLeish.
Not at all. I'll be looking forward to resuming these discussions in Washington or in Conway, Massachusetts, where I hope to look in for a day sometime this summer. Good.
This was the eighth of a series of programs entitled Report from San Francisco, broadcast to the people of America by the NBC University of the Air.